And yeah, I liked Vancouver, and but then I had to work, and so Gene's mom was a bill collector and got me a, and he said, so let's get a job as a bill collector. And I didn't like that. I wasn't good at like not being sympathetic and just demanding money, and but they thought I was good on the phone and good with people, so they made me the skip tracer. And I was good at that. And then do you know what that is, Bob?
No, skip tracer? No.
His job is to find the people when they're trying to collect a bill. If the guy split, now they can't even collect the bill because they don't know where he is. So now they got to go back a step and say, well, let's first find out where he is. Can we get a place of employment or an address or a phone number or even a city or where is the guy? You can't collect a bill unless you have the guy on the line.
And that's, doing that is called skip tracing?
That's right.
Yeah.
And
so you're being a spy, you're investigating.
Yeah, and in fact, it's fraud. It's in that you, yeah, I would, I mean, we had a confidentiality agreement because there were a number of techniques and we had access to stuff that you weren't necessarily, well, let's just say now, because the company's not there, I can say certain things that won't really, don't matter now.
Yeah.
But, like, we had numbers from Bell Telephone that all over North America, all area codes that you weren't supposed to have, that were internal numbers that were used by employees, where you could use these numbers and say, yes, I'd like to check a number, and you could get an unpublished number, address, and name, anything, any information they had, you had full access to it. And they would even change the numbers knowing that they had gotten leaked out. And often they would, like, when we would use those, if we had, like, a city or something with a non-pub number and we wanted to get the address, we would we'd get the girls in the office to make that call because 90% of the operators are female, so it already was a bit odd if a male would be asking for the information. So usually we get them call these numbers just because if they ever tipped off, you know, it's
yeah.
You're screwed. And we had different techniques that the RCMP had used to do the same thing, to locate someone, to pull, because part of the thing with locating someone was to draw them to you. If you couldn't get to them, you had to try and get them to you. So you put flags up that they'll see to come to you. I know it sounds abstract in the sense, but it would involve, like, send postcards to the last known addresses. Maybe they're being forwarded to the new one.
Yeah.
Say you're an old friend. Call that you're organizing, you know, if it's a student loan, say you're organizing a student reunion. Call the parents. Say you're a schoolmate.
So you did that in Vancouver.
Yeah, and then it started bugging me. Because I'd go home and get stoned and then recollect all the lies that I'd been saying all day to these people. And it started really freaking me out. I started finding it hard to get up in the morning. It really was weird. It got to the point where the only thing I enjoyed about my existence was sleeping. And it seemed like the 6-7 hours that I got to sleep, an alarm would ring, you know, to get up to go back to this office. And I remember, like, fucking, like, waking up with my, like, fists, like my teeth clenched, and like, oh, fuck, it's already morning. Shit. Like, actually hating the next day because it meant I had to go back to work there.
So did you do that for more than a year or less?
No, less than a year. I did that for about 4 months.
But it seemed eternity.
I hated it. And I would draw pictures of, like, people with chains, like, on their legs, strapped to chairs on telephones, leaving the office. They must have thought I was such a freak. But I was a really pretty good tracer when I was into it. I could usually, on a good day, get about 5 people, and they paid about $25 a trace. So in 1980 or 81, if you could make $125 a day, that was like, you know, you could make $700-$800 a week, which was enormous wage back then compared to, you know, and then suddenly it's like, hey, you're not making $3 an hour. Today, you just worked 8 hours, and whatever, you made like $13-$14 an hour. That seemed really good for money. So I liked that challenge at first, but then just killed me, the constant conning and lying and basically abusing all my nice nature, because I'm so, can be personal and nice, and I was just acting like my natural self but using it for devious purposes to con people. So I call up people's mums and totally ingratiate myself to people's mums, And they, I get them to totally sell their kids out. And I'd be sitting there writing all this information. And they thought they'd be bragging about what their kids are doing, thinking how proud they were. And meanwhile, I'm writing Owen's home, moved to Eugene, Oregon. God, I shouldn't have even said that. God, anyways, strange that you don't put that name of that city that I said in the area. Okay. Publish that. But anyways, yeah, so, but, so yeah, and then, so then I thought, well, fuck it, I'm not going to be in a band. And so I would play, whatchamacallit, I still was playing in bands with people.
In Vancouver?
No, when I went back after 6 months, I was lived in Vancouver for 6 months, and then my grandmother, Omi, was dying of cancer, so I came back, and that was just not fun, too. And I just felt helpless, and I knew they put her in for chemotherapy and that, and I, it just seemed like the hospital experience was just reducing your health, like, so fast, and it was just, now here, she's terminal, oh, God, and what do you say to someone when they can't come out of the hospital? What are you going to brag about all of what you're doing? So that was, like, not a pleasant time.
So in Vancouver, did you go up in the mountains and
yeah, occasionally I would. Yeah, I did, actually. I remember, yeah. And I would do magic mushrooms. I would pick them out there. I like to get stoned, and I would go out, like, to Mount Seymour. I remember, like, actually going in really raw nature and finding, like, a large pond, and it was so clear, and I could see there were, like, almost developed tadpoles. They're about to become frogs, but they weren't quite yet. And I just thought, well, shit, man, this is like totally clean water. I remember, like, yeah, swimming in it just on myself.
It's like totally clean water.
And just like, it just seemed pretty heavenly. I remember really, really quite. Vancouver's really nice in 1980 still, you know, and Gastown wasn't, there weren't junkies there. There was alcoholic native people, but they weren't really, didn't seem like a major problem, you know what I mean? They just kind of kept themselves for the most part. Wasn't like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It seemed pretty okay. Like, it was marginalized enough that it wasn't really affecting. Everyone else was still going about their regular business. And so it was nice. But then it boiled down to the, you had to work and make money. That's what I was, that was drilled into me very early. God, I sound selfish just going on. Bob, are you cool with this interview?
Oh, it's very interesting.
Yeah?
Because it's a, in some ways, it's a typical Canadian life.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a bit different, but, you know, a lot of kids were in bands and had to work. And the grind.
Well, the whole thing was like, you know, my parents were nice enough, but, you know, it was also like, well, you know, you're 18. You know, how long are you going to live with us? You got to get your own place, you know, if we want our house back or whatever.
Right, so the thing
that's
is...
That's a typical WASPy kind of thing. So then what happens is that you very soon find out, and especially don't forget, when I entered the workforce at the end of the baby boom, I'm at the end of the baby boom. I'm between Generation X and baby boom. So basically, when I entered the workforce, interest rates were 18%. All of, like, Ohio and everything was getting completely shut down. The mountains were shutting down. All the coal mines, everything. They were moving out of the old industrial era that they had going for the last 85 years. And it was moving into the transition where you needed less actual workers to do things. And just industries were just being moved overseas or whatever. It was a real dislocation. And I actually got a little thing going then when I got back from Vancouver before I then went to Ryerson, where I bought and sold guitars for about a year and a half. And
in a store?
Like, no, I would go to Cleveland and Warren, and I'd drive down in my car, and I would go and get the local papers, and I had the trading post from Chicago and Cleveland, and it was mailed to me, so I had it every week, and then I would just call them from Toronto. I'd see the ads of the stuff I wanted. I'm calling about your Gretsch guitar or whatever, and then I'd line them up, and then I usually line up my visits so that when I arrived there, their new buy and sell would come out too, so I'd sort of also try and hit stuff. But they were going through such recession then that there was all this really good gear. I brought back probably about 40 amazing vintage guitars that if I had kept them now, some of them, like the entire collection, it's obscene how much it's probably now worth. Like, yeah, just absolutely sickening, some of the guitars I imported into Canada. The most one that's probably worth like about 40, 50 grand now is I had a 19 that I bought for $675. I sold to a school teacher in Barrie up here for $1,500. I brought it to Ring Music because it was so incredible. He thought, maybe it's a forgery. Please take it to Ring Music. And I brought it to Ring Music, and they, like, first thing they said is this for sale? I said, no. They said, oh, you wanted appraised. And they had valued it at $1,800 then. But it was a mint condition 1963 candy apple red Fender Stratocaster with a spaghetti logo headstock. And it even had, I've never seen a Strat, the bridge guard and original strings. It basically had never been played. And the case was black, which made it seem weird too. It was the first year for black case, so it looked kind of modern. And it was so mint that, and it was right around the time when the Japanese were, because they were starting to be worth about $2,000, these things, were starting to make forgeries of the real thing and putting the Fender logo and selling them to collectors, you know, to make what would then be a fairly decent amount of cash. And shitloads of them I brought through. And I would just pop them for, all I wanted to do was make $150 on each guitar and clear a profit, and I was there. I remember I bought every Life magazine off this Vietnam vet in Buffalo around that time, too. I would pass through to Cleveland, I'd stop in Buffalo, grab their local papers, and I was, oh, every Life magazine ever made. And then, sure enough, he had it for $450. He delivered them to my rehearsal space in Toronto. Fucking boxes and boxes from 1936 right up to 1972, the last one. And I remember I poured through them. And then I used that. I sold it to an advertising executive. I remember I made, I think, $800 profit on that.
So you were buying them not just a
I read collector. That one as a collector, and then later I thought, I can use this to pay my tuition. I got it because now...
Well, you weren't thinking that when you bought them. You actually were interested in
them. I was interested in them, yeah. I read them, and I remember then I thought, I've got to sell my Life magazine collection so I can pay my tuition. And
okay, well, that gets into Ryerson.
That's how I got.
Why did you go? I mean, like, what did you think you were doing? Because my
parents said, you can't sell guitars. Because I thought, well, now I'm starting to figure out a way to like maneuver around and make more money than I would make if I had like a regular minimum wage kind of job. So I sort of thought, okay, and then my parents were like, you can't do this. What are you? You're just gonna finish school and then that's it. You're just gonna now just. Drive down to Cleveland and sell guitars in the buy and sell. So I'm like, yeah, I fell for them. I thought, I've got to get out of this. And it made sense. I've got to get out of it. I'm not going to be in rock and roll culture. I've got to do something. That's my youth. That's what I have fun doing. That's fine. But this is not, you've got to broaden your skills. You've got to find something that you can go and have a more tangible career.
And this is
so I thought.
Yeah. So
it's
so
funny because the guy who interviewed me to go to Ryerson ended up having Vision TV, and I always thought, that he was a very.
Oh, you mean that man. Dave guy?
Ron Keast, I think his. I'm pretty sure his name is Ron.
Oh no, I'm thinking of the Green Planet at a TV.
No, Vision TV, the Christian station.
Yeah.
So James Keast or no Ron Keast? Oh, I feel terrible. Because there's another professor, I think was. I might be mixing his name up. Oh, anyways.
What's your point? This is a professor?
Said to me, he was the one who. Yeah, he was one of the heads of the Ryerson Radio and Television Arts Program. James Keast. Ron Keast, I forgot. The last name is Keast. K-E-A-S-T. Really nice guy. Oh, he's a sweet gentleman type. And,
You went to
Christian
him.
Too, but not in like bashing over the head, in a very gentle United Church kind of way.
Canadian Christian.
Canadian liberal
Christian.
Exactly. a gentle Christian. Anyways.
But the thing is, you're talking about how you.
He said to me, he goes, well, how do you. He goes, you seem to be interested in music from what I can see. Why are you applying to this program? Why aren't you pursuing that? And I said, I want to broaden my knowledge. It's cool and all that stuff, but I don't think I want to, you know, like be in a rock band as a career. That seems like too big a gamble, too ridiculous. And just from trying to play in bands with my friends, then it just seemed, well, it's fun, but this is, I don't want to try and organize this into an actual serious living. Weird.
Considering how it all turned out.
It seemed like a proper job, yeah.
Okay, so what you said, what to him? He said you should be a musician. You say it's unstable.
No, he didn't say you should, because it appears that's what your aptitude or your desired vocation or your field of natural interest where you devote your time to. Should you pursuing that. And I said, no, I've had enough of that.
And what did he say to that? That you said
that's a valid thing to want to do, to want to broaden your knowledge and your knowledge of other disciplines.
So he let you in.
Yeah. Also, I had the high marks. So.
You would have got in anyways, but that's just something you remember about what he said.
I think so, yeah.
So you start going to Ryerson in 82?
83. Yeah.
Okay, and we're going to meet in...
late. So I'm a year... At that point now, instead of being a year younger than everyone, I'm like about a year and a half older than most of the kids. So then I go there. I've already been out of the school system for at least about a year and a half.
Well, no, three...
I finished grade 13. I've now gone to Vancouver, then gone back, and I forget the exact, spent it probably, back. So probably about a year and a half went by, and my parents are like, well, what are you going to do with your life?
But it's like, if you graduate when you're 18, that's in 79, and now it's 83, that's 4 years later.
4 years. So hang on a sec, then. I guess, so I might have graduated in 80. Because don't forget, I dropped out in grade 12, so then I missed a year.
So when you came back from Vancouver?
I dropped out of grade 12, so then I had to start up again and get my grade 12, and then go to grade 13. And so then I killed a year that way. Then I went to Vancouver, and then exactly like about a year and a half, 2 years went by, and I'm buying and selling guitars and doing that kind of shit, and playing in bands, and then realizing, well, this is crazy. Exactly, so by this point, I'm probably 21.
22, Dave, in 83, so it's your 22nd year.
No, because here's the thing is, when you're born in late year of the month, in 1983, you're 21 years old, right?
But you'll be 22, in October.
Exactly, so you start the program and you apply for it when you're 21.
Right.
Exactly, so when I join and I'm 22, so some of the kids exactly are 3 years younger than me, exactly. So by that point, so in other words, the year sort of killed by dropping out of grade 12, and then the year killed just working and just doing that kind of shit after grade 13.
And then a year in Vancouver, say, or half a year.
Half a year. So and exactly. So
and then you come back and half a year Cleveland.
Exactly. So I'm I'm 22 then, exactly, when I go to Ryerson.
The institution of destiny for you.
Yeah.
Because you're going to pretty quickly, you hear they have a radio station.
Yeah,
and you're older than the kids. You feel like you're a mature adult, so you got to get out there.
I don't feel I'm a mature adult. I just feel that I'm out of school and I don't like high school and I don't want to be back in the high school environment that I had done it and didn't want to go back.
You didn't want to join the frats or whatever they are.
Yeah, I didn't. I like being alone.
Are you still buying records like a real consumer?
Nope.
What?
No.
Oh, you're not doing that anymore.
Now?
Presently? No, no, I mean in 83 when you're right.
Oh, big time. Oh, yeah.
You're still time. A radio consumer. yeah. I mean a music consumer.
I became big pals with Scott because he was really into that. We would go over to Vortex Used Records every day at lunch just in case they had new stuff. And when
Remember Vortex, yeah.
Yeah, the one at Jarvis and Queen. I think it was at Jarvis and Dundas.
This is Scott Woods.
Yeah.
Who is a rock critic website now?
That's right.
Yeah, but anyway, so I'm interested. I'm going to meet you in a year or so, and you're at Ryerson and doing your radio, and you're imagining you're going to be a journalist.
No. At first, I'm not thinking journalism, but then I suddenly get interested in that on my own because I want to go to the Ryerson, and I know everyone wants to do a music show, so they're not going to let me on to play records anyways. And so I thought the news was what interested me. I wanted to do that because I thought at least that took some brain power and was a little more open-ended.
Yeah, because everybody else had radio show, music shows.
Music show.
So there's no slot for that. So it satisfied your need to want to know more about the world, and then you would broadcast it.
And also have a feasible... Yeah, it was the direction I wanted to go. I was serious about wanting to do that at their station, and I also wanted to do it because I realized that my chances of getting on to do that were higher than going on and doing a music show.
So, do we want to talk about your days in the Ryerson, or let's jump ahead to after Ryerson. How much do you want to go into this?
I find this stuff boring. This is, Bob, this is a pretty boring interview. I really fear that I just... You're letting me just like rattle on and on about fucking stuff that's really not that.
Well, you never know, Dave. You never know what's interesting today.
Yeah.
So it's interesting for me to hear your story.
Yeah.
Who knows? You never know what's going to be valuable. Mm. This may reveal the key to Dave Neufeld creating a new musical texture in the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, definitely your eclecticism in music. It's like that professor. He realized, hey, you're a music guy. What are you doing here?
Yeah.
So, are you DJing in 83, 84, 85?
I started about 84. I need to make money now because the whole gig was, my dad said, if you're going to go to university, I wouldn't mind, you know, helping you, but you have to put yourself through the first half of it, and if you get through that far, then I'll pay. And tuition wasn't that much back in those days. It was about like $1,500 a year.
So, oh. Okay, so if to you it's
so I had to keep working. So I saw a posted at Ryerson said DJ's wanted, Ryerson student will train. So I thought, great, there's a job I can do. So he came and asked me, it's funny you talk about eclecticism, he says, what kind of music do you like? And I said, I like everything. And so he said, well, that's good. So he said, so you're not going to want to play like certain music that you like that other people won't like? And I said, what, at people's weddings? Are you kidding? He goes, okay, that's good. And then so he basically showed me, he would say, okay, you know, and I would come to a wedding that he would do. And it was cute because he had these little sets. So he had these, like, certain tunes, and ones from all that time and that era that he knew, oh, well, this is how I'm going to get the dance floor going, you know. And it was all part of the gig to make the people's weddings happen. He didn't want to be a DJ and stiff the party. So, you know, it became a pseudoscience of what songs to pick and how to, like, ebb and flow the pace and keep them going. And, of course, he had some tried and true sets of music segueing certain popular songs into others. It was funny. And then, you know, and it'd be a thing where, you know, back in then they'd charge you about $200, which seemed okay. And he'd give you $75 and he'd get $125 or whatever, and he would... he would supply the gear and that. Well, very soon into it, I realized, well, I like doing it and I want to augment the records that he's giving me with my own, but he doesn't want me to do that. And then I sort of thought, well, I could make more money. He's actually not paying as much as I actually could be making doing weddings. So I went to this company called McMillan & Wife and applied there, and they liked my DJing a lot. They took me to a club that wasn't busy. Only like an off night, and he just sat there with his friends and he said, all right, let's see a DJ. And I just played about 2 hours of music, and he said, oh, I love your stuff. And it was all mainstream, basically, just totally, that would have worked well in the bar, because I wanted to play so that the bartender and the few people that were there would also get into it, because that was part of the test and the equation.
Yeah.
And that worked out really well for me. I did that for many years and had a lot of cool times and got paid really well. And that basically... then it forced me, obviously, you had to totally keep on top of the latest pop stuff. And, but it,
again,
it gave me free time to do music because there was no preparation involved in it. You just had to come on Saturday. That was it. Once the wedding was done, that was it. It was over. And you had the rest of the week off. And you could make, you know, enough to pay your rent, basically, even if you get to get one gig every week.
Okay, from 83, 84 till 87,
yeah.
You're doing the DJ and keeping up on the musical trends and,
yeah,
and new thing and understanding hooks and for different generations.
I suppose, yeah. And just being exposed to it continually, that's for sure. And certainly knowing in the public setting what songs are going to work and having a strong sense of that just automatically. You know, someone comes up to you with a record and says, hey, put this one on. You're going to check it in your headphones, and you're going to make a pretty snap decision, this will clear the dance floor or this won't. So I guess, yeah, it does force you to evaluate music on a really brute, like, is this going to get the crowd going right now or isn't it? You know, and people make these kind of judgments and evaluations of music, especially if they're DJing, programming it, because they don't want to put something on that people just go, it's lame as fuck, and let's go to the bar, let's split. And that's a big fear of most DJs. They don't want that to happen. They want to keep it cooking all the time.
So you're in McLuhan talks about the programming of the environment by different media agencies and environments. You were experiencing that as a programmer and watching the rhetoric and effects on the audience immediately,
exactly.
And knowing the whole, it's like an advertising agency. You know different types of
testing it on the
ear
audience.
Niches.
I've done many surveys with these tracks. Exactly, they've been well surveyed and tried. We've already tested them on audiences. Exactly, we've got already the figures, the polls, the statistics. We know the ones that are going to work and the ones that don't.
Ear niche marketing for each event.
Yeah, it is. They were all different, too. That the one group would be in the disco, and another one would be rock, and another one would be very square and country. Another one would be really eclectic, and another one would want R&B only. It was like, that's what I enjoyed about it, too. Even though it was almost all really mainstream, it would always be slightly different depending on the families and their kind of taste, if they're coming at it from an R&B edge, or from a pop edge, or from an oldies edge, or whatever. And I loved it. So many. I could just have so much fun, whatever angle. I could go to a Legion Hall and just have such a blast, you know, playing to like 200-300 people, just families and friends all dancing. I just loved spinning the golden oldies and shit like that. Just because, I mean, those are hot tunes too, you know, when you're slamming into a nice segue and it's just everything coming at the right time and the energy levels peaking and just the great hits coming in right at the right moment. It's fucking fun, man. I would have a hell of a time. I'd have as much fun. People would say that a lot. They go, I don't know if we should pay you. You look like you had a lot of fun.
So it's like, dispensing a drug. It's like being a musician on a stage and getting the audience effect.
Yeah.
And you're watching these people have a great time. And there's nothing wrong with that for making a living.
Exactly. And then I met these kids at the record pool. And I don't know how I met. Oh, I had something in the buy and sell. And he called about it. And then we got chatting. And these are two Italian brothers. They had a record pool, which was basically that they had convinced the record companies, the majors, and even the smaller ones, to give them free records, that they, like 20 copies of each one, that they would give out to DJ at clubs in return.
Yeah.
And they charged, and then of course, they charged the DJs like $80 a month or $100. It still seemed like a good DJ deal to the DJs, because it worked out to like maybe $3-4 instead of like, you know, $8-9 a disc. And so I had said, oh, well, you guys can get any record. Do you have First, Last, Everything by Endgames? Because I could not find that on vinyl, and I heard it on CFNY and really thought it was a cool track, and you just couldn't get it. And he said, no, because I think I had said, you know, someone should fucking remake that tune, man. It would fucking sell like hotcakes. And he said, yeah, and I sort of mentioned I got a studio, I think because he was calling about some piece of gear, and he said, can I do this, do that? So he came over, and I basically said, yeah, I can make that record. He said, so he got a shitty copy of it, because I just, you know, duplicated it with just, you know, drum machine and...
What year is this? Are you at
89.
Oh, but that's
so it's after CKLM.
After Ryerson.
After Ryerson. So at this point, I've already... So basically, after the whole thing with CIUT and CKLM ends, then I'm like, okay, now what do? I feel totally alienated from the whole business. I'm not going to be in radio. No one's going to let me in a mainstream station. CBC's not going to hire me. I'm a freak. The CKLN thing's been taken away from me. I don't want to chase ambulance journalism. I don't want to try and conform and be in part of an institution. I already know I don't fit in. And so...
So this guy comes over and you make a record.
Yeah, he says... Yeah, well, basically I'd make it, but yeah.
That was your first studio...
That was the first record that I released that was pressed. And it went pretty good. It charted and it got in... actually fairly good rotation. Like I would be coming home from I forget what job, but I remember hearing it, they had In Excess, Need You Tonight, or New Sensation, and then it came on after that and it sounded really good.
Yeah.
I'm laughing because they made it in that apartment, you know, and with a little Yamaha NS10s, and I remember when I would DJ it at the club, I realized, ooh, I had like a real muddy bass thing going because I couldn't hear on the NS10s, and they don't really have much below 100 hertz. And but it did well, and they made a video for it. And the weird thing was, it crossed over. It got played a lot on CFMY, and on Energy 108, the dance station, too. It actually crossed over to both formats. And then I went on Electric Circus, actually. That's how they actually asked us to be on it.
What's that, Electric Circus?
That's a show on City TV. I don't think it's... maybe it's called Electric Circus. I don't know if they still have it. It went for many years. And it was like every Friday night, they'd play just disco and people would dance. You know, like that show like Boogie or Soul Train, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it was run by City TV.
Okay. And you would say you heard this song when you're coming home for your jobs, meaning your DJ jobs. That's the only jobs you were having at that time. The only work was DJ. You would hear it on the car radio.
No, I guess, yeah, but I don't know why. Because I remember being in the 401 in... Yeah, maybe it wasn't coming from a job, just some chore or errand or something that I had to do. But I remember just having to sit in traffic with everyone else in the working world and listening. And I could remember it comes on and I knew it instantly. It's like, oh, shit, there it is. Like that. And so, yeah, that was the first one. And that was pretty good. It charted on the dance charts in Canada nationally. And it was Cash 22 is the name of the project. And we did a lip sync of it on the City TV show. And
I want to say this. So yeah. In from when you were at Ryerson until 87, when you leave CKLM,
yeah,
that was your bookish intellectual phase, right? You were reading a lot then.
Of course. Well, yeah. And constant information gathering with the Ryerson show. That news wave was like an hour-long show every day. And I think I did three of them, hosted three of them.
A week?
Yeah, and then prepared... Yeah, and then I had to make sure on the other two that they'd be filled in with enough stuff. Yeah, that was a full-time job.
Were you reading before Ryerson a lot?
Yeah.
You always were reading leftist literature?
No. No, I was more into...
The Christian effect.
Christian, more like Eric Hoffer and Ayn Rand, and I was into that kind of stuff.
Well, what flipped you?
I was pretty damn open to... I'd say the Ryerson professors in the first year, they were all Marxist or socialist, very leftist. So they exposed you to all that class. And I remember really never thinking the Marxism, the class analysis was so good, but I was more interested in the class. Like, I didn't like it from the... I never really thought of it that, oh, I feel like a communist or something, or I'm going to join the class. I always thought that seemed kind of just pointless. But I remember being really taken with the media analysis, the class analysis, this whole sense of, yeah, of the elite groups owning and controlling, you know, culture and, you know, being consciously a dominant group, you know, and that, and then the underclass and all that, and then the whole sense, yeah, that you know, that a lot of this stuff was a giant brainwashing device and being pawned off as a, you know, as whatever,
as
objective news or something.
Education and information.
Information, exactly. So I remember being very struck by that, and also very struck by Plato's Republic and my philosophy teacher, too. I remember that was what I brought more from Ryerson. I remember I liked the elective course, the philosophy and political science and sociology, more than the course. I hated radio and television.
More than the technical stuff.
Yeah, I hated that. I did not like the Ryerson course. I think the only stuff I liked was that, and I took advertising in third year, and I quite liked that. I loathed TV. I just hated it. I hated the camera, stuff like that. I hated fucking around, making pretend crap with tapes and phony radio shows.
Remember you made the documentary on Bob Marshall?
Yeah, with Tanya.
Yeah, with Tanya.
She went on to have a very successful career, by the way, you know that, eh?
On City TV.
Yeah, now she's at CBC.
She's like a producer?
Yeah, or something more. Yeah, exactly.
She got a job pretty quickly after graduating. She's been working ever since, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But now the... so, yeah, I see you were this Christian American individualist or North American individualist Christian guy. Then you went into the collective leftist writings and ideas and class now. So then you felt righteous about that and screwed up your relationship with Helen because of that.
Right.
And you're righteous about broadcasting and countering the capitalist propaganda.
That's right.
On Ryerson.
Reagan. That was the whole idea that those guys were
Reagan era.
And liars and they shouldn't be in Nicaragua and all that. Exactly. And I was going to help expose them.
And then Iran-Contra happened. But you were off of CKLN when that happened.
That's right. Then I was still following the stuff. I was more than we were doing that CIUT show. We did that, remember, for a few months.
You and Nelson, yeah.
Yeah.
And Bob Marshall.
That's right.
Yeah. But the thing is that...
But then I was sick of it because I realized this is all this work and it's all this great stuff and I'm not making a fucking penny off it. So then I started thinking, well, if I'm not going to make any money off doing news, then... Because you bust your ass to do good work. I did. You know what I mean? You want to get in the air and prepare reports. Well, you gotta, that takes time and work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe not for you. You can just go on and just start dialoguing. But if you're trying to put a new show, you can't just go on and just merely dialogue. You could, maybe. But you know what I mean? That wasn't what I was doing. I had to prepare reports.
You were a news director.
News director and interview people and have some variety and sense of, yeah, that you have your headline news and you have your...
All for free.
All for free. And so then I thought, well, if that's for free and I ain't going to make any money doing that, I probably have more fun smoking joints and playing around my computer.
Yeah.
And
you had bought a computer while being news director.
And I still was DJing, so I'm like, well, I'm living in my apartment. The rent's only $280 a month. And I can DJ. I can make $800-$900 a month. So, you know, about my third, my income's going to rent. So it's like, it's doable.
Did you buy a computer while still being news director?
No.
Somehow the computer...
I went all through Ryerson without a computer, unfortunately, and still had to do all my essays on a typewriter, which was a fucking pain in the ass. It really was. You know what I mean? Because you make a spelling error on page 5. And, you know what I mean? You just got to fuck around with whiteout and retyping. Just horrible. Just horrible. The kids have so much more of an advantage now.
Yeah. Well, I never went through that, but that sounds horrible. But the... so you get into computer, you discover computers right after getting out of CKLN, and then that's going to really be a big... That's going to become your main medium for your life so
that's
far.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
I just want to go back. I remember you interviewing Chomsky and having her Bob Marshall stuff, LaRouche, the Executive Intelligence Review, Mae Brussel, yeah. and you would complain, or you actually asked Chomsky, what's your view of LaRouche? And how come you don't have an interest in his information?
Yes.
And he said something like, well, I think they're a joke, those guys. I never thought they were serious.
He said they were, he kind of said too, they started a race riot in Boston.
Yeah, yeah, the activists.
They weren't cool folks.
Yeah, they weren't nice to the lefties, and they caused fights within the activists, what was left of it in the 73-75 period.
Right.
So, but anyways, there's a lot we could talk about in the Ryerson stuff, but we're going to move into the music. We've been talking for an hour and a half, 2 hours or something.
Shit, dude.
So anyways, I hope it's coming through clear on the mic.
Yeah.
So let's go into Lee.
Yeah, you're registering on those green things, see there?
Okay, good. Yep.
Yeah.
So the thing is we're going to come up to your period at Stars and Sons, you know, your recording studio. So you go through the late 80s, early 90s, and then Nelson Thal hires you to make the Bosmy Ecology albums and the McLuhan albums. So that gives you a lot of experience, a lot of time and payment to learn about
computers.
That
was a windfall. That was a godsend.
Yeah.
I was fucked. When I wrote to him...
To who?
Nelson. After I, you know, there would be points when I would not have DJ gigs. And everything would fucking fall apart around February, March, and you don't get DJ gigs. People don't get married in those months.
Yeah.
There's no Christmas parties. There's nothing going on. So the business dries up. So that's when you start having to sell gear to pay your rent. And so we have to raise $400 here and $400 there.
I wanted to ask, how many albums do you take to a gig?
Oh, I used to take about 5 seal test cartons and about... You know, like a couple suitcases full of 45s. So, I was the last guy on records at the last guy to go to CDs. I really held on. I really liked the vinyl.
But you took about a couple hundred albums?
Yeah, you took 4 or 5. I think you played about 80 albums in a seal test carton. So you'd probably bring to a gig about, 400 records and
a bunch of singles.
A bunch of singles. And that would probably give you enough variety of music to cover your typical requests that you probably get, and certainly more than enough music to fill, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours if you need to go that long of nonstop music.
So you have no money in that February, March period, and you said you wrote to Nelson?
Yeah, because he had put up money to get this guy, John, who I met through Dante, wrote simulators. Now, at this point, I'm already doing music. I've met Jerry Belanger. He knows of the first, last, everything, and so he realizes, okay, this guy can make records that are successful, because that record was it had a fairly strong chart presence for many months.
It's called First, Last, Everything?
Yeah. I mean, it's crap, ultimately, but in its time, it was like, wow, you made that in your bedroom and everyone knows that song, or they did at the time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it just gave me a sense, okay, so I'm DJing, and DJing in this club called the Dufferin Gate, which for 5 years, totally unpretentious place. It's a Newfie network. It's almost like I belong there.
Newfoundland.
Yeah. And so, like, they're pulling a lot of the waitresses for, they're all Maritimers. And I loved it, you know. It was owned by this older Greek guy, Steve, and he was really cool. And it was just an unpretentious restaurant, you know, kind of blue collar. And I just found the people just really friendly. And that goes a long way with me. And, so I played there. So it wasn't glamorous, but I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
That was your main DJing gig?
No, the weddings too. But I would do that every Thursday and Friday. That was a guaranteed income gig.
Yeah.
This definitely. Is just to top up the cash, just to make sure. Because you wouldn't always get, not everyone every week you would get a gig for a wedding. You know what I mean? You know?
Yeah. So that's Dufferin Gates. So Belanger.
So I would play like tracks there and the same. So then I got more of a taste for like, making a record that kind of just that whole sense, okay, I want to do that too. I want to be one of those songs that'll get played or be very involved in making, you know, even if I don't write it, then I want to be involved in helping like to realize it so that it'll be one of those ones that gets played between all the other ones that are so cool. So suddenly you want to be able to accomplish the same thing. I'm playing all these other people's tracks. Fuck, I gotta make something so that I'll actually, as a DJ, go, let's put on that.
Yeah.
And that is such a challenge, you know what I mean?
To make music.
Not just, making music's not a challenge, it's frightfully easy. No, to make a track like that, you know, that has that fucking quality or something.
And what is that quality? You mean popularity?
That is just an undeniable track that you just know, you know what, this is just going to get a lot of people going because it's just something really charming or just something very present in there or just realized about it. And that's a huge, great challenge, you know what I mean? I mean, that even, you know, that's of interest even to a nuclear physicist or a quarks physicist because it almost is like that because it's like, they can never make that into a true science even. That's what's so neat about it. So, like, now you're trying to make something that has a tangible result. I want to make a really effective, cool record that people just want to hear. Like the guy who has, like, the best ride at the CNE and everyone's lined up. Oh, you got to go on the roller coaster. It rocks. You know what I mean? So, I want that in, like, a song form, too. Because that's what I've seen. It's like I'm so, you know, into the fact that, yes, there are great songs, like Motown ones and that just get people going.
They become part of the tribal encyclopedia.
Yeah, and also just the art of just it's like making a movie that makes people cry or a horror movie that scares people. It's just, it's such a neat, and just a challenge. It's not an easy thing to do. It's very easy to listen to a hit song and see what the elements are and duplicate it. That's technically actually doable with a little bit of effort. You can do that in your bedroom. But, to originate that kind of thing, or to have a huge role in doing it, that's the holy grail, especially if you got the writing on it and it becomes a hit. So, I don't know if that'll ever happen to me, but that's like an underlying thing.
What do you mean that you don't know if that'll ever happen to you?
Well, I've had records that have had success, but I mean a hit. I mean, I hit like Mambo No. 5 or Macarena or Can't Get You Out of My Head.
Yeah.
Or... You know what I'm saying? Like,
but you know, that mass market isn't there anymore. It's all fragmented.
Yeah, but there are still songs that then will still stick out that almost everyone knows and crosses over to a lot of different stations. But I agree that you don't get that. And I know, and this sounds like just more like a content thing, but I found that, or found by 92, the decline of singles markets in a lot of ways, in that the guy who I worked for 20 years, a McMillan, the wife, Scott McMillan, he would say that. I go, oh, any good new songs, you know, this anything I should know about? He goes, no, it's all shit.
There was some kind of...
And that we said, he said, there's now, because we started, I started, like, he started in, like, the fucking 60s, like, playing Tommy James and Sean Bells and Led Zeppelin. So you can imagine how exciting it was to DJ back then. You know, really exciting. Wow, I gotta play these songs tonight. I can't wait. Woo! And now it's just like such shit. Fucking
in the early '90s.
Yeah, it went that way then. It just all seemed like, ah, we've heard this crap before, and this isn't that much fun, because we had just gone out of the '80s, which was actually a really strong period for music in terms of pop music.
Yep,
it really was, and it was also very strong in crossover. Because when you go to these weddings, you could play Pointer Sisters and Bruce Springsteen and Tina Turner and Bruce, who else, even a bit of U2, but, or Tears for Fears even, and certainly the Michael Jackson and the Lionel Richie and the Huey Lewis and the News and the Prince. And this was all like massive music back then. So most people would say a lot of that is rubbish, I suppose. It's not rubbish. It's well done music. It really is. That was what was massive. Those, once you got around 92, suddenly the big bands that are like Tiny Pockets or stuff like KLF, which is, has no appeal to people over 40 years old. Suddenly it's like you've got a generational gap I'm noticing happening again, that all in the 80s was an issue. I could easily go to a wedding in the 80s and put on Kool and the Gang or Sheena Easton or Laura Branigan or all that kind of shit. That they, and it would fly with like a wide generational thing. And then,
but not in the 90s or something.
No, it started to decline, and then suddenly it's like, and then you've got like the heavy guitar alternative and stuff like that, and then you start putting that on, you get people coming up and going,
plugging their ears and yeah, complaining.
Yeah, this shit. Yeah, and I remember I disliked that aspect of it. So then my strategy was I just kind of bypassed that and just played a lot of disco and oldies, which it worked anyways.
Yeah, so you're saying that in the early 90s there was a some kind of quality cheap. Or fragmentation, diversity that nobody...
That didn't feel like it was mass marketable music anymore, that it could like play to a whole family without alienating someone.
Right, so you
whereas
you
had, in the 80s, the bulk of the pop material that they churned out actually had a wide generational appeal.
So now you have a studio... Yeah. You have this home. I was there once, your studio, and you're making records. But are you? Do you what in the basement? Do you like? Do you like the music you're making for bands?
Well, I'm not really making a lot of too much external music for bands. Just other like obscure projects, other solo artists that want to make dance records. So I'm doing stuff with them, different people, and people coming with projects.
That's not wedding music. You're doing club music.
Oh, no, it's so far away from it. And I'm not doing those kind of wedding music hits because I don't really have the equipment or I feel at that point or the vocalist or that to do it. I'm just interested. I just want to make some cool stuff. And then I make that first, last, everything really just as a deliberate attempt to duplicate. But I didn't duplicate it, but to make a specific record. But that's a whole different way.
For the dance world. In other words, this is a whole subgenre market
exactly. That's
open to experimentation.
And so, yeah, well, definitely, especially with the remixes, you try and make the first signal mix or the basic coherent version. And then, yeah, on the 12-inch, that was a part of it, too, is then you're supposed to make variations that are a little more creative or loopy or freaky. Loopy, not in the looping sense, although that's obviously a big part, but loopy in a like, bit left field.
And that's when you made Bob's Musicology 2, exactly. You would so throw in this dance kind of mixes.
That's right. So I was pulling in, and that was like, those albums, it's hilarious, because they're actually done with incredibly primitive gear by today's standards.
Yeah. They're like, pretty good for the technology you had.
Well, the first Bob album is basically a Casio FZ1, a Korg M1, being triggered by a Mac Plus, and a lot of your stuff was just all put at low res into samples on these floppy disks that I'd have and just load them into the keyboard, and no digital audio, none of that shit. And then what happened was, right as that's in progress, the digital audio thing hits and Nelson buys the Mac computer to run a two-track system.
Right.
So Bob's Musicology was basically done on the FZ1, mixed the FZ1 and M1, mixed down to a DAT tape, and then Nelson gets the computer, so I then get the DAT tape, all the different mix downs, and put it all into the computer, and then edit all the sections together. So that was that, and that seemed like a godsend in the time. And that's his two-track editing, but it seemed really great. And then we got the four-track system to do the next one with the cold cut and shit like that.
Stein CMS Media Native one. Yeah,
and then I upgraded my synth sampler from the mono FZ1 with 30-second sampling time, and got the Kurzweil K2000, which all of a sudden you could put Sims chips, like the same ones the Mac, rather than buying a proprietary chips, which would have been insanely expensive. Like the FZ1, to upgrade 1 meg cost you $500, you know, but a 1 meg Sims chip is probably $19 or something. So suddenly it's like, oh, fuck. And it's stereo, and it's got, you know, double the polyphony, and blah, 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 and an incredibly powerful synthesis and ability to manipulate the sounds and samples. And it's just light years from the FZ1.
You mentioned Kurzweil. That's Ray Kurzweil's contribution?
I think so, yeah. If he started that company, and the Koreans, Young Chang, bought it, and they took the design. And so it's a South Korean company, and it was a very successful synth that had wide market penetration. In fact, the one I've got there is the K2500, and I got that because it has double the polyphony of the K2000, and also the D to A converters are sweeter sounding, because I remember that was the one thing I didn't like about it, is that it didn't have a sweet sound. It would play back what you put in pretty close, but it added some kind of cold metallic quality or something. Just never, you could just hear it wasn't quite as sweet sounding as the original single. Whereas I found like other stuff, like even then Sonic and Roland and Emulator, definitely, and even Yamaha, was everyone else's samplers seemed to have a sweeter sound than that. So I remember, but this one has, it's almost the same thing. It'll read all my old library, but yeah, they put in better converters, and it sounds nicer.
And what's it called?
K2500, yeah. But it's still very old school in the sense that it's you know what though? It's old school in the sense that it's really keeping the same, it's just a refinement of the design from 1990 that they put out, but you know what? It does what it does. That's the thing, is they upgrade all this shit. But in the end, the initial thing that it does is such a strong function that when there's like a technological period, like with the tape deck, that was like 25 years. Once you had a tape deck, you didn't keep really upgrading it. Once it worked, you were supposed to, well, just go use it now and record music. Don't keep thinking about, I got to get a different one. And you've got it now. And that's the same thing. Like my computer, my program is about 5 years out of date now. But I don't want to change it yet. I want to, but it works so fine for what I'm doing and fulfills all the tasks that I'm trying to do that I don't have this like burning desire to change it. Like literally, I just feel it's so advanced over a tape deck that they would have had, you know, even 20 years ago, that it's just unnecessary. Anyways, I'm getting tired of talking gibberish, dude. This is going to be a terrible interview.
Don't worry about it, Dave.
No one's going to transcribe it, because it's just boring.
They're just going to listen to it. So the thing is that you are doing this dance club stuff in the middle 90s, supplementing your income with the gigs at Dufferin Gate and
dance. Yeah, and the weddings, yeah.
And then...
And also taking the money from that I made then, because what happens is I do the first Bob album.
What'd you say?
I do the first Bob album. And it's like a modest fee, good for its time. I think I take 4 or 5 months, and Nelson gives me a good deal for back then.
Good payment.
Oh, yeah, he pays me like something like $1,500 a month or something to do it, which then seems like, wow, fucking right. So I'm really down with that. And then I do a good job on that. And then I'm at his office, and he says... So you think you can do the same thing with McLuhan? And I'm like, fuck, I'd like to. Definitely try. Because he'd like, obviously, you know, because it was almost the same thing. Yours was all these cassettes of your radio show. And the same thing. He had all these cassettes of McLuhan's. He's like, okay, so we've done it for Bob. You want to do it for McLuhan? So then he upped my salary to $2,000 a month, which really seemed good. And Nelson's attitude was, you go ahead and take fucking 8 months or whatever to do this. So now all of a sudden it's like, now I'm making more money than I've ever made in my life.
Mm.
And so I thought, I can actually save for the first time in my life. So I actually saved, I don't know, like about 12,000-14,000 bucks. I think I sold some gear too and invested it in stocks, believe it or not. And my peak on paper, within 2 years, I was about, I think at one point, even though I had about a $42,000 loan overhanging it, it was about $160,000. So it's quite a substantial money on paper. Never changed my lifestyle, really. And then the Briex thing happened, and I just lost it all. Bing, 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 bing.
What's the loan? Is that from, you mean as a student? Or
no. When you invest in stocks, once they go over $3, you can actually borrow money at a very low interest rate from the brokerage firm if you secure it with your existing holdings based on their market value. So in the case of the stock, if let's say the one that I had, 10,000 shares, that and it's, you know, that I've bought for, say, 30, 40 cents a share, and now it's $7 a share. So my $3,000 investment now is worth, $60,000, $70,000. And then, so they'll allow you to take 60% of that value as long as the stock is over $3 at some firms, other firms $2 if their margins are limit, or the bottom line before it's not considered a marginal stock. And so then suddenly you have a loan, guaranteed loan that you can start drawing from. Well, if it's worth $70,000 to $40,000, and so the brokerage firm will encourage you to do that because you're churning up the stock market, you're generating commissions for them, and that's what they're there to do, to trade, sell, buy. And so it all works fine, but then when you get a Briex and the whole gold sector collapse overnight.
That was a scandal or a conspiracy or something?
That basically... they were salting the gold samples, and they had said that they had basically, found some insane, like, 80 million ounce deposit or something crazy that would just, like, make up basically a 25-year mine. So then everyone, the Bushes, were trying to muscle in on it, and then all of a sudden, and then Barrick does, and then all of a sudden they pull out, and because there's anomalies with the testing, and they do some independent testing on the samples, and so they had said that they had been salted, the samples. Some guy took gold dust, and it sprinkled them in.
Mm.
So they would get these grades. And they had a market cap on it of, $5, $10 billion. At one point, I think it was almost as much as the Royal Bank or something insane. And all the big firms, like Nesbitt Thompson, they're all hoiking it up and pushing it. And so that collapsed the gold market. And it was maybe good in the long run. It really fucked me up. I never really got anything. I took a trip to Mexico. That was the one thing I got. But I actually started becoming a bit lazy, drifting off, just thinking, well, I got it made. I'll just wait to double it one more time, and I'll never have to work a day in my life. I'll have a house, and I'll have the money in the bank, and I can live the life of Riley.
And this is 94, 95.
That's right. Yeah, after I broke up with Gogo. And,
but it didn't happen.
No, exactly. Then I lost it, and then I was like through a really bad situation, and
had to work more as a DJ. Probably.
Then I had to, or just continue with that. But and I was writing songs and doing band stuff, but never getting it past the sort of writing stage, and so then. Yeah, I thought I gotta stop fucking around. If I'm gonna do music, I don't want to make fucking piddly little fucking dance records. I was already listening to the dance music. I already saw that very early in it, by the early '90s, that it was disposable. That even if you made a good record in 2 weeks, most people would not give a shit about it. So then you're realizing, you know what, I'm totally just involved in a very frivolous content providing kind of situation. But that's not to say that there's not a lot of great dance music that isn't frivolous, but I just felt where I stood making records in my bedroom that I, you know, would be not making cheesy dance music, but it just felt limited ultimately. It's like, it was just like what I felt when I was 18 or 19 with rock music. Like, this is cool, but it's not enough.
Yeah, you're always searching for something rich or meaningful or something to do. Well, economically motivated.
Motivated. Well, it has to be. I mean, you just can't get around that. You can't plan your life without also accounting for, well, how are you going to pay the bills? Unless you're independently wealthy, you know what I mean?
But you couldn't, you demanded a kind of richness in your experience. You couldn't take the superficiality of just making a lot of money.
No.
So that's when you got the studio, started to really...
That's right. I had that place, then I split with Scott and set up in the basement and had, you know, I started, you know...
Being a little more a studio and having bands come in.
I started exactly going out and seeking bands and thinking, I've got to get something going with that. So I started, a friend of mine, I forget how I met him, but this guy, Steve Poppyseed, was organizing a lot of gigs, and he would organize tribute nights. And he did one, Burt Bacharach one, and I played at it with Gene in his band, and we did a great cover, actually, of This Guy's in Love with You. I did like a Hendrix-y version. It was really good.
As a band, you were playing guitar.
And then they came on and they played Trains and Boats and Planes, and I just thought they were great. And I had seen them one other time at some other show and didn't like their cover of whatever tune it was and thought they were just a very noisy sounding band.
This is Gene's band.
No, Mean Red Spiders. But then I saw them that night at the tribute, and they covered Burt Bacharach's Trains and Boats and Planes, and it sounded great. It was just, I thought, just such a great sort of application of their sound. They just seem really realized. It's like, oh, now I get it. Okay, cool. The noise actually sounds great. It works brilliantly. And the singer is totally cool and has a really laid back, dreamy kind of quality. I love it. I love it. So I approached them, you know, and said, hey, I've got, you know, a 4-track Pro Tools system and, you know, a nice board and sampler and some mics. Let's fucking, I'll show you some stuff I'm doing. Whatever, you know, because we were smoking joints, too. You always got a nice marijuana binder, and that's how you, you know, it's almost like booze in that sense. Then you can go backstage because you've got a joint, and so you're getting stoned with people, so you get chatty, you know what I mean? Start talking about music you like and what you're into and what you want to do. That's what I really like about pot, you know what I mean? It tends to, in the right situations, it gets people, you know, a little outside of the box or a little more, you know. It can be a social lubricant, just like booze is, but even though you wouldn't think it is, in a lot of ways it's a very uniting thing, getting stoned with someone and talking with them, you know, or with strangers. I've had many good conversations with total, complete strangers at smoking a joint in some kind of party or something, getting stoned and then just chatting, you know, the real bonding that takes place. So
that was your first...
That was the first, and that was like a real, like, okay, we're making records. We want to make records that are going to get good reviews and are going to get on the college charts.
Who's we?
Me and the bands.
Oh, okay.
Whoever I'm working with. We have a unified goal, and that certainly is my goal, too. And then that turned out really cool, and there's another band right in that same scene, Neck, and we made this brilliant EP that I still think is just fantastic and just sounds great, and that got really good reviews, and then that spun off to other work, and then I thought, I remember Steve Poppyseed, I was thinking, I kept seeing this garage that had a for lease sign on it, and I kept thinking, I wonder if it's the whole building or just this garage. And I thought, if it's just the garage, maybe it's like not totally expensive. It was right downtown, and then I thought, fuck, I bet you could play music in this too. It looks like shit, man. So, and then I forgot about it, and I kept going by the place, you know, because I would always be going downtown, and then, after about the third time, I said, take the number and call. So that's basically how I got that place.
That's Stars and Sons.
Stars and Sons, yeah.
And that's about 99?
Yeah, because Steve Poppyseed said to me, fucking, because it was almost like you'd make records with people, but it's like, what would really give them incentive? You know, yeah, sure, the quality of work you do is really good. Maybe they'd recognize it, or maybe they think, no, just we can go anywhere and make a record. It's all us, anyways. So the thing was, there was a sense that, well, why, yeah, what would make a band want to keep going if they had anything really substantial going? Why would they wouldn't go up to Bathurst and Lawrence to go into my basement? There's not even an ISO booth, you know, when they're playing, you can hear it in the control room. So when you have the playback, you can't even tell when you're recording what it's going to sound like, because you're hearing it coming out of the room as well, besides just the speaker. So it's going to sound different when they stop playing, you just play it back. So it wasn't a proper studio, so I was toying with the idea, and then I thought, I don't know if economically I can do it. And then I remember Steve, I'm sitting at a Chinese restaurant, and Steve Poppyseed said, well, why don't you either fucking go big or fucking go home? And I thought, he's right, man. It's like, don't be a fucking wuss, man. You're fucking now, you know, whatever. It's like 1999. So at that
You're point, almost 40. You're 38.
That's right. Exactly. Yes, I'm almost 40. Exactly. So it's like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? It's like, time just zooms by. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
you acquired the studio, and then you got lots of fringe bands, and that was good.
Yeah.
And then Broken Social Scene showed up.
Yes.
In 2002.
That's right.
Were you aware of their previous album before?
No.
You forgot it?
No.
You didn't even know about them?
I just saw their name once in the paper, and it looked like Brendan Canty was in it, and I thought, well, that's interesting, because I was working with Jose from By Divine Right, and that was the band Brendan was in before then. And, you know, and it kind of, they all just sort of just didn't end on the best note, and it was sort of a shame. Well, Brendan came in later, he wasn't the original member, but they had their band made of some really hot albums that I really respected. And so I was working with the guy from him, and I remember he was not, a little disappointed. Oh, the champ, as I called Brendan, he's not even going to check out my tunes or work on the next album. They kind of all bailed on him, so...
What's Brendan's last name?
Canny.
Yeah.
So he had, so then I saw Brendan Canny, Broken Social Scene. I thought, oh, that must be a reference to just the fact that it's all kind of gone sour, the whole BDR thing and starting from scratch. And
what's BDR?
By Divine Right.
Yeah.
But so it wasn't, you thought it referred but it back? But it didn't, it wasn't a reference really to that. I forget, it's something else more to do with him. Kevin came up with that, I don't know what, but it wasn't what I thought it was. But that was the first thing I noticed. And then
they approached you.
No, because basically also this guy Dylan played bass then with Jose, so he was kind of palsy. And then he had a side project with Justin Paroff, who's a drummer with Broken Social Scene, obviously. And so they wanted to finish it, do the overdubs, and have me mix it at my place. They had started it at their own place on the computer. And so that was a really cool experience, and that's when I met Brendan. He came in because he was friends with them and Justin, and then I said, oh, I'm making a Pet Sounds record. And so we did a Junior Ponte one.
Pet Sounds, that was your own 10-year project.
That's right. 10-year project?
Well, you've been planning it for a long time,
no,
right?
No, I wasn't. I planned it for just a... When I planned it when I... After I got that studio, that project basically was about a year and a half, and then I sort of just abandoned it, basically, and I was too busy with BSS and other records.
And that's in 2001. You meet Brendan.
I start Pet Sounds in 2001 or so, 2001, I think. How can I was a vehicle to really get the studio going and work with a lot of bands, and I thought, well, here's perfect, come in and do one tune. And it's actually a really cool album. A lot of recordings are good. I gotta take a leak. But that's how I met them, because I asked Justin, well, you've got your Junior Ponte thing. You think that other band, Broken Social Scene, you think they want to do a Pet song? And he's like, I'll ask. And then.
You mean you want bands to come in and contribute to this project?
Yeah.
Where they would take songs from Pet Sounds?
No. It was called Pet Songs rather than Pet Sounds. Oh. Sorry. It was originals. No, songs about pets. So they had to come in with a song about pets, and I would produce it.
And if you made an album, sold it, they'd get they're one little percentage.
Yeah, however that would fucking work. It would be actually a nightmare problem, but yeah.
So, it's, but this was how you brought bands in, how you met people.
That's what it ended up being. It seemed to like suddenly that project suddenly really widened. Because I wasn't waiting for them to come in as customers.
You were inviting them in.
I was inviting them in a very semi-non-committal way. And also the quality of my work was good. I had enough work to show that I was doing actually really good stuff. So
they could be associated with you.
Yeah, it would attract people if they didn't know who I was. You know, but and it was a great offer, you know, record for free. You know, and basically, you know, you can. And I would say to them, I go, well, you record it here. Because I wasn't paying them. I said, and you can put this on your album. But I can put it on my Pet Sounds album, too. That was part of the deal.
Yeah, they could use it, and you could put it on your project.
Yeah, so it seemed really cool.
And who was it that you met Brandon before, but who did you invite Brandon in?
No, Justin did. I forget why, for some reason, or he just said, hey, I'm working with this guy, Dave. And he goes, Dave? Yeah, he's a studio downtown, right by where he lived. He's like, really? I don't even know. So he came over, Justin invited him. I was mixing one of their tunes when he walked in, and he said, oh, that's a creative mixing.
You're saying that Brendan commented in hearing your work.
Yeah, he walked in right in the middle of a mix and moving the faders and just, I guess, the way I was pushing the sounds and the way it was set up.
And he goes, that's creative mixing.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you've got, so then that leads to Kevin?
Yeah, because then I go, he says, yeah, come, Kevin will be at this other group, Raising the Fawn, that I'm playing with. He had actually said, I'm going to be splitting them, I think, soon. I think he said, this is my last gig I'm doing with him, you should come and check it out. And Kevin was there. And then we met. I liked Kevin. I thought he seemed fun.
Now, that's 2002 now, right?
Yeah. That,
okay.
That is, yeah.
There's been a lot of documentation and interviews about the your experience with them, what you did, and let's jump up to now.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk where we are now, or do you want to just evaluate what did you learn as you got older about the music industry, and what did you make of this whole blip you guys made as Broken Social Scene, and you got a higher profile than you would have ever imagined you'd get 10 years before.
That's right.
What did you learn from all that, if you want to talk about it?
What did I learn from it? I don't know what I learned from it. I mean, I've learned a bunch of things, I suppose. You know?
Yeah, what's a couple of things that you, what do you make of the industry? What did you learn that you didn't expect by becoming successful?
Not much.
Not much?
No.
So what does that mean? That means that the success doesn't have anything to do with the actual
quality.
Love of making music and keeping doing, working
That's
in the studio.
That's what it was in the end. I always thought, like I would hear my stuff is flawed, like that first Bob record, all of those, and I hear them, you know, there's aspects of them that I love, and I'm like, oh, I don't even have the energy to do that kind of editing and wading through materials. And some of the music's really cool, sonically, you know, sometimes it's limited, other times it's really cool. So the arranging and the music, some of it's cheesy to me, some of it's dated sounding.
What you've done.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about what you've done.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I can totally hear. I mean, I like those records on a two-way. And in one way, they're also very derivative of all the things that are happening at that time.
Bob's and Ecology albums you're
talking
about.
Oh, yeah, sure. Any of them. McLuhan and all of them. Some of McLuhan I hate listening to. It just sounds like really cheesy synth music. But at this time, it sort of seemed okay. You know, there were definitely points where I thought, this is pretty
People
cool.
thought it was good.
But the...
Do you say that about the music you made in the late 90s, when you rehear them?
I mean, it sounds vague. I find the stuff that I do in the experiments that never get completed. There's a lot of stuff that I do that I think sounds cool, even if it doesn't get completed. That I like, but what was your question?
You were talking about how inadequate some of the Bob's and Ecology sounds now, and
Even then, I remember like I would hear it on CBC, and then they'd put on some hip hop song afterwards, and then I'd think, oh, you know, I could step it up many more notches than I have
before. But you had pretty primitive equipment compared to these other groups then.
Well, the thing is, you know, real proper hip records are, you know, a lot of times they're made in better monitors than I had. I had $300 monitors and a cheap amp. Mm. You know what I mean? I had a proper, and I was with this little Roland console. But on the other hand, you know, it also showed me when I listen to those records, they do sound good, and they're not mastered like records are now, so they're about a third of the volume of a modern record, too. And I found, like, you start slamming those old mixes and that through, like, a limiter, and it's like, it actually sounds really good, and the board actually sounded really good for a little cheap micro board, you know. And
you're talking about Bob's Meat College.
If you, like, remaster those, and it's like... You can, like, make those songs really smash you now, like to be sound like the leap out of the speakers considerably more than they do on that album. Like, that album isn't really mastered. It's just mixed down in an early digital system.
Yeah.
It's not maximized now, so it's probably, like, about a half or third of the volume of the record now.
But do you feel...
so when you look at it's cool, but it's also dated...
But when you look at stuff you did in the late 90s and before Broken Soul Scene, you have the same opinions that you were part of the moment, you picked up on what was going on, did pretty good, but...
This sounds vain, but I think, like, with some... Then I started to really, with bands like the Spiders and the... Is really apply kind of what I had learned from doing dance music and the DJing thing and my just love of cool music in general, that I actually... I even then... was fairly pleased with the work that I was doing and started to think, yeah, I like what I do, and I actually think I'm bringing something good to the sound of the bands that I'm working with. Like I'm actually thinking, no, this is actually pretty good. Like it's pretty cool by any standard.
But when you look at what you learn, you say you didn't learn much about the success of Broken Soul Scene. That's because you knew a lot about the industry in any ways and saw bands come and go?
I didn't learn much about the industry from being with Broken Soul Scene. I basically made records and never really got in the accounting end of it or the distribution or the schmoozing or the touring. So nothing really changed much for me, really. I just stayed downtown. They moved on and traveled. I just stayed doing the same thing I was. Now, that was my attitude, is they were a great band, and the quality of work that I was doing was really good, and the quality of work they're doing, so our timing was good. But, like, when I hear the Neck album and stuff like that I did at the other place, on the Allen and Heath road board, I mean, that Broken Soul Scene album, everyone, like, that was tracked and mixed on a road board. Most bands would not come into a studio if they knew that. It was a $2,000 console. They think, well, whatever, we should just go along with Quaid and rent one or buy one then if that's what we're using. They want to go in and record on, you know, higher voltage, something special or something. You know what I mean? So
you're saying you're not offering something really that they could go to better studios.
Yeah, all the other studios had better gear than I did at that place, but...
But people do come to you.
Just because the way I engineered and what I want to try and achieve in the mix, that you can make even... I like having good gear, and it does make a difference on the console, but it's like driving a car. If you're a really good driver, give me the shitty Volvo and then put someone that isn't so experienced at driving and put them in a Corvette or something like that. Yeah, they might outperform me, but chances are, just if with driving skill, I'll probably be able to take a turn almost at the same speed as they are, because if they're not as good a driver, they'll probably be skidding around even in a really good car that can handle properly. So that's the same thing with the gear, as I found, is you can, even with relatively cheap gear, and that's part of the problem too, when you have a studio, you kind of have to have like racks of cool gear and that, or else if you don't, even if you can make good records without it, because then you can, obviously, you're not going to attract clients, because they're just going to think, well, why don't I just buy them that gear? You got $3,000 worth of stuff here. So, I, to me, it's just a refinement, augmentation of what I'm doing, you know. And I know out there's producers that make really big money, and I have this weird thing that I could just overnight become completely obscure and irrelevant and never get a good band ever come back to me, you know, and be begging, no, Broken Social Scene or someone with some degree of note, please let me work on a project with you. And just, you know, be out here, out in Eastern Ontario, and just getting totally obscure bands coming along with projects I don't like, you know. It could go that way, you know. I mean, I've got the really good gear and all that stuff, but that's what I think. I don't really think I've learned a lot. In a lot of ways, I feel like I'm almost in the same situation as I was. The only difference is I've got a little more money and a little more gear to sell off if I had a rainy day. And I guess the big difference is, but I still have to pay for it, is I own, you know, a substantial building.
Property. Substantial. I got an idea, but before you said, you were saying you're still the same as 1989, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I would say that that you created a sound with the help of Broken Social Scene, or they were created it with you, but you created a texture of sound which is unique. And you told me that you can hear this sound, this effect. I don't know what they call it, the wash of sound.
The wall of sound, which is, of course, a Phil Spector.
But, yeah, but there was the recent Village Voice review of Feist.
Yeah.
Mentions the wall of sound effect or whatever it was.
Right, right.
So you were key in making that. And you say you can hear that in previous bands' albums you did.
Oh, fuck yeah.
So you created texture. So in that context, you have added something.
And bands that I worked with since then. It just ends up sounding that way. If I'm sitting there, not just engineering too, it seems like you're just kind of encouraging it, and it just steers itself in that direction. It just seems like a natural direction for the sound to go to me, and it makes sense to the bands usually too.
And I bet you.
And I don't know why, and it's not something I created. I mean, the weird thing is a lot of it is mundane. It's like Stars and Sun to me is like, I love that mix so much. The way that mix went down is I put on the Tragically Hip Music at Work on those JBLs, and I thought, this sounds really fucking good. And then I listened to, and it's like I'm mixing Stars and Suns, and I'm A-B-ing it with it, and I'm like, I gotta make this fucking sound at least as good as this Tragically Hip record, man. So I just sit there hammering away at the sound just till it's like, you know what, it's working in the speakers the same way there does. So it sounds like that song sounds really cool and indie and all that. But actually, I'm actually attempting to try and get a sound as good as a totally mainstream band that's like, I think is a great band and a killer vocalist. But it's a huge band that appeals to, like, it's got a huge blue-collar kind of hoser thing, like Led Zeppelin would, you know what I mean? It's not considered a hip band, really. And that's mundane. There's, you know, so it looks like, you know, you get, and I have certain techniques, and some of them I won't even reveal, because they're actually really simple, but, and I just notice most people don't use it, and it's something that I just stumbled upon myself.
Years ago.
And it's a huge factor, and I just, like, I just find that, yeah, I use this certain techniques that I guess make the record sound the way what people are saying them, especially in terms of stereo panning and placement and sense of what is the center, and is this something on the right side or something on the left?
Yeah.
That kind of sense of placement. Is it here or here? Is it all over you, or is it really just here? I like playing with that a lot. And then you want to have lots of cool sounds to weave in it and shit like that. And it just seems, it's not like contrived. It's not like I gotta set out to find a new way. That's what I find weird. It's really just the way I work and tend to approach it like that. Then I just notice after a bunch of records, okay, yeah, I do now hear it is starting to sound. I can sort of tell, yeah. And then obviously other people are saying the same thing. I can tell that you worked on that record. And
sounds like you massaged the acoustic space around the
ears. Yeah, and I wanted to keep like absorbing the ears so that you're kind of taking it all in at once, and that you're hearing that one little thing there, and then just the right time, then you'll get drawn to that, but that they're not clashing, or not like fighting with each other. So they're kind of all being celebrated, but each one's taking center stage for a second, or one might stay very center stage. I always just feel like that. There's always like, what is it?
This shifting.
What is, yeah, what's pulling me in? And they're obviously always supposed to work simultaneously with each other, but, you know, you always feel, well, someone's got to kind of be also a bit of the central focus, kind of, even though I got all these other sounds going. And then it's like, when I pull a focus out of this guy, I want the other guys to come in focus just right, not a delay, like if it was a film, you know, it's like you're pulling the focus, you don't, like, then just go out of focus and everything. You might pull out of focus, but you bring, what's the new center of attention, but not just nothing, unless you're trying to end a scene. You're deliberately going for that, I suppose, or end of a tune. So
you think that
that's
something unique to you, that you came up with a unique way of modulating it that other people hadn't developed yet? And it's like a quadriphenic wall of sound. It's like a more subtle figure ground shifting going on.
I think that it just, a lot of people are doing that. And then, you know, then at that point, it's just like, it's like saying, did you invent lead guitar? No. But you have a certain couple pull-offs or a little hammer style or a few little things. But otherwise, no. I play pentatonic scales generally. And it's a very, it's a combination of Eddie Van Halen and Jimi Hendrix and Jeff Beck or whatever.
Right.
Or Johnny Marr and thing. Pick your era. You know, I'm old school, so I'll tend to like still make references to big bands of that nature. But
the textures, though, come from
more just than, yeah, so then they say this guy's got an original style. It's kind of like, I suppose he does have an original style that was formed from being influenced by a shitload of other guitar players, if a guitar was an analogy for that.
But I think it's your richness, it's like Finnegan's Wake, you layer in so much music that you've absorbed since you were five.
That's what it is, and I want it all or else it bores me.
Yeah, you want it all. Constantly repeat all of it.
Yeah,
with new shifting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's your contribution.
Yeah.
To the musical encyclopedia that's continuously being developed.
Yeah.
Well, I think we explained what the beginning of the interview was about your youth and how that came together. It kind of fits into what you just said. That was very good what you said the last couple minutes there. Mm. It's the same as what other people did, but there is, because when Forgotten Purple came out.
Yeah.
When that came out, people said, wow, this is a perfect record. It has mainstream stuff in it. It's got the hooks, but it's got the experimental and the avant-garde and the other textures.
Being well represented.
Right, which is exactly what you've portrayed over the last 2.5-3 hour interview, that's what you did very early. You were picking up the new stuff because you were a paper boy and guys dumped albums on you through that, and then you learned all this stuff, experienced it, and was always modulating the mainstream, the Jacksons, as well as whatever obscure thing, Led Zeppelin or Zappa or another, kept always modulating these different, the spectrum of pop culture.
Appreciating it all, like enjoying it all.
Yeah.
Like getting a rush off all of it. That's the thing.
And that's what's interesting. To me, that's what Zappa was like.
That's right, he liked cheesy music, too, and doo-wop and cheap songs.
And classical music and jazz. Classical music,
yeah.
So I see you as an updating of the Frank motif, the Frank modality, the Frank eclecticism.
Yeah.
The Frank Zappa eclecticism.
You know what was a big influence on me? The Twin Peaks stuff. I remember.
Really? Thinking, that's David.
David
Lynch's own the guy he had, Angelo.
Yeah, I thought he was fantastic, and the mood of his tunes I really dug.
Did you watch Twin Peaks? Because I used to emphasize the show. Or you were into it on your own?
Eric Yalen showed me the initial episode. I had never seen any.
Oh, you didn't watch it at the time?
No TV.
Right, because, you know, I was going on about it on the radio show with Mike Dyer.
Exactly, and I had no clue what you were talking about, but I didn't mind.
Years later.
Eric Yalen showed me he had it on a DVD. And
that's when you made the video with Nelson?
That's right, right in that zone, exactly.
93.
Yeah, it wasn't DVD, VCR, but he had taped it. He had a call. He wanted to see the first Twin Peaks, the David Lynch one, and it was great, and it was a beautiful-looking thing. And then
but
I
the
saw
music.
The Firewalk, but the music. I remember Mike Dyer would play it, I think. Doom.
Oh, so you were tuned into the music.
Even I remember hearing on CKLN.
On our show.
Guy, everyone thought it was hot. It was hot. It sounded like Scott Walker or something. It was moody as fuck. It was right up my alley. And that's the kind of stuff I really enjoyed.
Scott Walker is something we share.
Yes.
But anyways, so Twin Peaks, that sort of made you think of imaginatively sparked you about textures or something of music.
A bit, or just, not even a bit, but also just, well, because it was using elements that already existed, obviously, like that guitar sounded like The Ventures or Duane Eddy or stuff from that era, but placed in the sort of moody, pseudo-adult, easy listening,
Muddy Mood Wake. Muddy Mood Wake.
Yeah. I remember just thinking, this is just truly groovy mood stuff.
I think it's Lynch gets co-producer on that. I mean, he tells Angelo what he wants.
Right. Fantastic.
Badalamenti, is that his name?
Yeah. I thought that was great. Really did.
That was in your mind?
In my mind, even if I'm not making music like that, it's always in my mind that if I have a track that starts sounding like that, that's a good thing. Not because he did it, but just because I love that kind of shit. And I mean, I like the Ferrante and Teicher and certain stuff. I like certain covers of songs and easy listening music. I find later in life I would listen to it and actually go, you know what, this is actually really well recorded and really well mixed. I thought it was schlock or just boring.
Moon River. That kind of stuff?
Even that. Yeah, you'll listen to it and you'll just go, listen to the fucking like flugelhorns and listen to the like harps and it's actually a really good arrangement. Oh my god, listen to the like background vocals. They sound so weird and far away and the reverb. It's really actually cool, the recording, and it's really trippy sounding stuff. Again, I have a pretty wide appreciation of them because a song like Moon River, that was a massive hit. I mean, I don't think when I was a kid I would have heard Moon River and go, oh, that's a shit song, turn it off. I would have appreciated that.
But you're saying other stuff you might not have appreciated, now you appreciate.
Yeah, like Ferrante and Teicher. Mm. Some stuff like that. Yeah, that I probably would have liked that then, like their version of Midnight Cowboy. That's the thing.
So do you like Muzak?
No, not when I hear that. Not the Muzak that sort of represents the Muzak they would have played 60s, 70s, 80s. The bizarre thing now is Muzak is like, a lot of times it sounds like there's like, oh my god, that's a cover of Roxette, or that's a Eurythmics song, or there's Tears for Fears. It doesn't sound the same. Muzak now is almost just to play even like the actual versions. So I noticed like at like Dominion, I remember noticing it's like, this is supposed to be kind of Muzak, but it's actually 80s, like, they're playing, like...
It's not the original track, but it's
it's the original track.
Oh, they're using the original as Muzak.
Yes, it's background. Here's some...
So Broken Social Scene will become Muzak someday.
Maybe in 20 years, exactly. Yeah. Who knows, there'll be, unfortunately, a time, I don't know, I might not be around, but those guys will, is when they will sell, like, the best of indie rock thing, you know, in, like, remember those, like in 2050, it's so sickening, in between like the funeral home, life insurance, and Geritol ads, they'll have like,
Broken Souls, Stars and Suns.
Here they are, the original tracks, as originally remastered.
So, at another level, that's interesting that the music got crummier in the early 90s.
Pop music.
So it actually went down to Muzak level, even though there is lots of new, better production.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it Muzak level. It's just like something like KLF was a really cool song, but I noticed that one you put on just clear all the adults there. You just lost all the parents. Mm. It's like, and I didn't have issues with that in the 80s. It's like I put on Lionel Richie all night long or Kool and the Gang Celebration or something like that. And that's it. You've got the whole family going.
Right, but there's something odd
where... It's not that it was bad music. No, but then it became shit. By the mid-late 90s, it just became so industry where it's like, all right, rock is umpteen years old, and this is the fodder merry-go-round of content. And then it all becomes so safe, it's all put through, it's all the same studios, like country music, Nashville shit. Is like,
well, that sounds like Muzak, but it ain't
it is like
good,
Muzak,
but it ain't good enough to be Muzak, so they use 80s stuff for Muzak.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. In other words, having hard upfront textures now is Muzak. Exactly. Mm-hmm. True, that it doesn't matter, you can still do that.
It's the Muzak, year is Muzak.
So, it's so predictable, the sounds, like that snare in these Nashville tunes. Well, it's always the same, the guitar sounds always the same, it's not like the same Telecaster through a PV amp or something. I don't know.
Well, we've gone into the digital Android meme so extremely that people aren't stimulated by the ear. They're stimulated by something else. We call it the tactile proprioceptive or something.
Yeah.
So that the ear has become minor concern, so they can just massage it mediocrely, yeah. While people are involved with an ESP or interactive instant messaging, which might create another kind of music. Well, rap and verbal music is indicative of the change.
Yeah.
And that's a big topic, but I think we've gone on long enough. I gotta get up and have a press conference tomorrow, Dave. So announce big developments in my life. So
really, eh?
Yeah. So it's been a pleasure talking to you, Dave, and hearing your story. Yeah. You're a very interesting person. Happy to know you. Happy to have been there and tracked all this and be your sort of substitute father. You know, the other mentor in your life.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll come up with some funny way to end this, so we should just let the tape run and keep it going. The interview's over, and then we'll just emphatically say goodnight.
What time is it?
4:30.
Oy vey.
We started, I don't know, 2 o'clock. This must be 2.5 hours or 3 hours. So, Dave, I don't know if I'll get a chance to come by here and do this again. If there's more to say, there might be, but I like doing it this way, so I'd rather do it here. So I'd have to come back here to do it. I wouldn't want to continue it on the phone.
I just think it's...
You never
boring.
Know, Dave. We don't know.
I think I'm boring.
You may be the last creative genius in the ear world. And so this is a documentation of your psychology and your sociology and where you came from.
Well, I hope in detail. That comes. I like some of the work that I've done, but I have yet to have a body of work that I think this is just better than anything that's out there. And I don't know if I have that in me to make that. I'd like to do that. I'd feel good. It'd give me a lot of personal satisfaction. Even if it didn't make a lot of money, it would just make me think, you know what, you did your work well, what you did. Even if you didn't make a lot of money, you did it really well, what you did. Even
we have no art. We just do everything as well as we can, as the Balinese says.
Really, eh?
Yeah.
There you go. I'm definitely living in a Balinese situation.
But you're building it. What?
We all are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the values of our time. People, whatever they do, they just say, well, I'm trying to do as best I can.
Yeah.
And usually they don't do that very well.
No.
Because that's a chemical body desire. And there's so many other bodies now that confuses it. Competing.
They're confusing it, yeah.
So you've got this new place, which is an expression of your desire to move to a new level, to make even better stuff, to do it better.
Yeah, and also to not picture myself, you know, living on a park bench with a bunch of gear in storage and not owning a roof over my head and being 60 years old and thinking, God, I'm still where I am when I was 21.
Yeah, coming back from Vancouver.
And that's what it was. Dude, 2 years ago I was still in that almost situation where it's just like, well, I don't know what's going to wait me after all this. What am I going to do? Can't, you know? And then I thought, what am I going to do, you know?
Then you got beat up. Which
got
then you won the settlement, which saved you in creating this situation. So
it salvaged this situation. This situation was already created before I got beat up, per se.
This situation what?
Was already sort of on, like, in... Like, whether I got that settlement or not, I'd already settled on this place. I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to get now a big settlement, so I should buy a place. That's not at all. I got this place from money that I had saved up from the BSS stuff.
Before you got beat up?
Yeah.
Yeah. By the New York cops, for the record.
Yeah.
And then that was a disaster, but then in the long run, the beating up helped you keep this place.
Salvage this place.
Salvage it, yeah.
For the time being.
Which I told you at the time, just on the record, I predicted that the beating up would create a good effect somehow.
I remember when I asked you that, it was almost rhetorical. I go, Bob, I just knew you were going to say that. I thought, he'll say that even if he doesn't think so. Just because it's like the sensible thing to say, too.
No, I believed it.
No, you would have said, I don't know, Dave. You probably would have said, well, your odds aren't that high or something if you felt that way. I'm sure you would have said that. But yeah, I remember when I'm asking it, I almost could predict. I know what he's going to say. He's going to be positive and say, yeah, you know what, even though it seems crazy, something good. So it was a partially a rhetorical question. You know, when you almost like, if you had said, yeah, you're going to be fucked, I probably would have challenged it. Well, are you sure?
But I actually believe it because I've noticed that in my own life. That in the long run, nothing really becomes a disaster. It actually
but
fits
in.
But
like a real setback, it fits in the jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah. In the long run, it sends you in a direction that you'll need in 2 years that right. you didn't know you would need. And it doesn't look like you want to go there.
Yeah.
That's yeah. the key to calmness in your life.
Right, when those disasters fall, just knowing that, yeah, but once you get over this, there's some
slack. It's going to trigger some other potentials.
You don't need to freak too much.
What?
I know, so you don't need to totally freak out and panic.
Okay, Dave, so I got to get ready for tomorrow.
I'm going to just go in there and just grab a little something to eat just because it's fucking, it'll start to fill up.
So they come at noon, so...
Oh, Jesus, are they?
It doesn't look like Interview Magazine is...
Holy shit, three and a half.